Hello all, welcome to the God Said a Boast podcast, a content channel of Kai Drakonis Books. I'm the editor of Kai Drakonis Books, Patrick Barney, and we're going to talk. I'm with a guest today, Chris Malmberg, which, you know, everybody who has listened to the podcast in the past has heard him. We talked about Moby Dick, which has been the most popular podcast so far. And really, it was quite an excellent one, I think. Before we get into the thick of the discussion, it's going to be on William Somerset Maugham's Of Human Bondage. Before we get into that discussion, I just want to remind everybody that the press, Kai Drakonis Books, offers all of its content free of charge. So that includes the books that we've published. We've published three so far. All of them are free. You can go to kaidrakonis.org. That's kaidrakonis.org. Send me your name, your email address, and your mailing address, and I will mail you a print copy of all three of the books we published, or just whichever ones you want. The reason that we do that, the reason that we share our content free of charge, is because of our anarchist values. So a lot of people misunderstand our anarchism, and they think it's all about violence and, you know, destroying things with bombs. And there are a few of us who have done that, but really it's just about resisting authority and resisting, specifically, it's resisting all types of authority, but a major emphasis is resisting capitalist authority. So as a statement against capitalist authority, a statement against hierarchy and commodification and whatnot, all our books are free. And so if you want to get down with that, cool. So Chris, I know we, in a preliminary discussion, we said that we had some mixed feelings about Of Human Bondage, and you indicated that you felt like it was an expanded version of James Joyce's short story Araby. And then you told me to read it, and so I did, and I definitely feel that there are some comparisons or similarities that can be made. Do you want to expand on that? Do you want to explain what we're talking about?
Sure. And I think like I made that comparison before finishing Of Human Bondage, and I do think that Of Human Bondage, like as a novel should, completes a more detailed picture and also progresses further. And so it ultimately, I think, makes a slightly different statement. Mm-hmm. You could say that they follow the same arc for, you know, I mean, Araby is like 3 pages long, but I felt like Araby comprised the first third anyway of Human Bondage.
Okay.
That's maybe like, that's kind of a silly statement, but as far as like what it was covering and what it was sort of reflecting and sort of the different things that it was dealing with, Araby as a short story really focuses on a small boy about 11 years old who, is somewhat disenfranchised, but not totally disenfranchised. Relatively speaking, he has a lot of good things going for him, because he's not a child laborer or anything like that. But he's not a rich or wealthy or upper class young boy.
Right.
I believe he's got family taking care of him. I don't have the text in front of me, but I believe his guardians are not like his parents. And he's also framed on his street by, very clearly by religious institutions, religious academic institutions. He's got a priest, who is either a neighbor or a roommate. I don't remember. And, and all of that sort of informs this sort of like very structured idea of society in which he fits. And he finds himself just sort of obsessed with a little girl who lives nearby in the way that like a child who has very nascent, like just like the very first ideas of attraction, those ideas of attraction sort of take him over, and he becomes very obsessive, not in a creepy way, but just in a little boy kind of way. And he promises to get her something from this bazaar, a market. It becomes like this quest for him. And it's a quest that meets very mundane sort of like barriers with his family who, you know, don't want him out. He's got chores, you know, like his guardians don't want him to go. And finally, begrudgingly, like as an afterthought, he's allowed to go just before it closes. It's been this, you know, entirely domestic, not very fraught, except in his mind, experience when he finally gets out there and it's closing and he's surrounded by adults living their lives, you know, working at this bazaar, getting ready for the night out. I think two women giggle about a man's affections. The man's not present. They're just talking about him. And he realizes, he has this just sudden realization that everything he's just done is sort of meaningless. And he is not actually driven by anything that is important. This was all just vanity. This was all just him needing to feel affirmation from this girl. And it's horrifying to him. It is this, like, acknowledgement that he will always be trapped by his own compulsions and trapped within them. And that is a lot of what I feel like Philip in Of Human Bondage is continuously wrestling with. And he really, I think it's a remarkable book, Of Human Bondage, because Mom allows for so much sort of direct, open-eyed commentary through Philip on Philip's situation, which is really quite astounding, because it doesn't come across as pedantic, because Philip really is in a sort of a Sisyphean. Is that even a term? Sisyphean?
Yeah, I think that works. Sisyphean?
Sisyphean, yeah. That might be better. The Sisyphean struggle to own himself and or to surrender to himself, you know, and he talks about, I mean, like it's something that he recognizes, but then he can't do anything about, like when Mildred comes back, before leaving with Harry, you know, and it's like, he hates her. And then she comes back and it's like, oh my God, I always loved her. You know, it doesn't, there's no control. And he comes to sort of like different stages of understanding that control might not be the point. It feels like, you know, whereas the protagonist in Araby is left off at this, like looking forward at this just unending struggle, maybe I'd be curious to hear your opinion of like where Philip is at the end. Maybe Philip finds himself with more at a kind of like a sort of like content resignation with the struggle, but I'd be curious to hear what you thought about that. That's where I felt like the two mirrored each other, except the Of Human Bondage went further and allowed its protagonist to develop a more detailed understanding of this human situation.
Right. Yeah. With Araby, the protagonist is as you say, left hanging in this dilemma of meaninglessness and lack of control, Whereas at the end of Human Bondage, there's definitely some sense of closure. And I definitely want to respond and talk about, you know, maybe what my own interpretation of that closure is. Though I also wanted to point out something you said. What did you say? It totally went out of my mind. But it was something neat and important. Maybe I'll remember. Maybe I'll remember. But, so, I did a little bit of research for this. Not a whole lot. But I wanted to, you know, the title of Human Bondage, I wanted to read this book because, for two reasons. One, it was actually, if I remember correctly, it was George Orwell's favorite book. And so there was just a little conceit in there. I was like, I want to see if I like what my favorite writer likes. And also the title really much, very much intrigued me, Of Human Bondage. And read on a surface level, I took it to mean, I took it to talk about, you know, I thought it was going to be more of a commentary on work or, the capitalist system or something like that. I took it very literally.
There's a little bit in there.
There is a little bit. I don't think he's totally ignorant of it, but that doesn't seem to be the main issue. Oh yeah, that does remind me, where you were talking about how Mom does this direct commentary on Philip's life, and it's not pedantic, and I agree with that, and that's actually something that I kind of like, and I'd say it's a technique that has gone out of fashion or gone out of style. I'm not exactly sure why it's gone out of style. Maybe it has something to do with leotard and meta narratives and whatnot, and how writers no longer want to speak in the meta narrative fashion. Does that make sense, or am I just bullshitting there?
I think also you could say that, like, with the end of modernism, when the nuclear bomb went off, the conceit that people could speak authoritatively about our situation in the universe, that anything existed beyond our immediate experience, became sort of laughable, like almost masturbatory, you know. Go ahead.
I definitely agree with that. I definitely agree that that is what people think, or what became popular. I don't actually agree with that, but go on.
No, I just think, and I think that there's actually sort of like glimmers of that. Like, it's sort of one of the things that I felt about this novel is that, like, you could write this novel, and I could, if like this novel, because it is sort of an idea novel,
right?
Which I think is what you sort of lament being out of style now.
The idea novel.
Yeah,
a little bit.
Like, the literary ideal novel. Now it's like, it's not really couth in literary circles to write, to be an idea novel writer in this.
To have some type of central argumentative thesis that you're trying to expound upon.
Unless it continuously unmakes itself.
Like, right, exactly.
That's where, like, the unbearable lightness of being comes in, which is sort of like this book. I mean, I guess, like, you could probably refract a lot of books through this book. But because it's like an idea, it is like this just so intricate, so involved Bildungsroman over the course of this guy's life.
Yeah.
That it is just sort of within. So I wrote some notes last night. It's kind of the book that makes it unnecessary to write any other book, because there's simply nothing more that can be said of or explored within this systematized myopia.
Right.
Where I guess like people are just so trapped within their emotions.
Right.
But I say that now. I feel like I don't know. I also wrote, in the end, Philip is a white male with enough momentum and money to survive his protracted adolescence. Right. That's cutting this book short, because it does have these like moments where comments on this real struggle he has, sort of, he calls it the pattern, like structuring his life. And he wants it to be, in the end, a beautiful pattern and intricate and interesting and, you know, travel, see the world, think big thoughts. And then he's like, well, you know, in the end, he's, you know, the simple pattern. Maybe that's something to take pride in. But it's still not relinquishing control. Like he's writing this sort of, I guess, like proto-modernist idea of like controlling your life and having control, mm-hmm. and putting effort into something and having an amount to something. And he can't quite reconcile that with this impossible, with the impossible truth that he has no control. And even in the end, when he is like, well, maybe simple patterns are best. And he makes this choice, which I think is a very brave choice, you know, and a very interesting one, that he's going to marry Sally and settle down and be a small fisherman village doctor.
Right.
You know, he's still trying to own that life. I don't know. It felt like. Like he's almost sort of tricking himself into believing that he's rolling with the punches. But I don't know if anything I just said made sense. But
no.
I do feel like there is like this weird sort of like, it's somehow this book, and it feels like it encompasses the struggle to, I mean, it was written in what, 1915?
Yeah, I think that's when it was published.
Parts of it feel very almost postmodernist to me.
Like what?
I should have written notes okay. down.
No big deal. In total, it strikes me as a totally anti-postmodern book.
We'll talk about that. Like,
not necessarily like it's consciously trying to undermine some of the ideas that were introduced by post-structuralism and whatnot, because obviously it comes before that mostly. I mean, I guess Saussure's ideas about linguistics were published the very next year in 1916. Is that correct? But of course,
yeah.
You know, developments didn't come out of that until, you know, the 60s or something like that. But it goes back to what you said before. There are still, in fact, much of literature deals with ideas, even today. But you said the literary idea novel today has to continually unmake itself, right?
Yeah.
And I find that so interesting, because for my next discussion with Hans, we're reading a book called A Naked Singularity by Sergio de la Pava. Have you heard of it?
No.
No. But it's really hilarious and fantastic and just an awesome read. But that idea of continually unmaking itself is... it totally captures what it's doing. So it feels like a novel that is at the same time trying to critique the idea of a meta narrative that you can have some kind of truthful discussion of reality while also speaking in very general terms. It seems to be critiquing that idea, and at the same time, it desperately wants to hold on to that idea, you know? And so it's unmaking itself, as you say, whereas Of Human Bondage doesn't have any of that, doesn't seem to have any of that self-doubt or that kind of doubling back reflection that A Naked Singularity has. And you know, to me, it reads very much just as a straight Bildungsroman, and Mom is like, I've got this idea that comes from Spinoza's ethics that human emotions are more important than the will. They control us. We don't control them. And I'm going to explore how that plays out in one human being's life over the course of I guess it's what, 15 years or something like that. And so it doesn't have, and this actually I would say comes from Nietzsche. Nietzsche had this feeling that he constantly needed to double check his bottom assumptions as he was proceeding towards conclusions made on those assumptions. And I think that's a very, that's the same thing you're talking about, where you continually unmake itself. And you know, Nietzsche is the first postmodernist, I think.
You know?
And so, I don't know. All I know is I don't think the book has that, and that's okay. That doesn't bother me. As I said, while ultimately I think A Naked Singularity might be a better book or a more enjoyable book to read, I find it very frustrating that the author's not willing to commit to anything.
Yeah.
And that's something that at least Mom does very well. He commits. He's like, this is my idea, and I'm going to explore it.
So, now you put me on the spot with my post-structuralist comment, and I think it came from, like, this idea that the book does not really commit to an understanding of the idea that sort of generates it, that ultimately, like, there is no center, but I think you're right. I think it commits to, even if what it commits to portraying in my mind is irreconcilable, it's still not post-structural. It's still right. Committing to that structure. And I think you're absolutely right. I have a couple quotes that kind of, like, I think speak to.
Let's hear it.
Yeah. So, yeah, this is, I think, right after he gets his heart broken by Mildred the first time.
The first time.
Talking to the first time.
After, yeah, like, four times or something.
Yeah, exactly.
Do you know what chapter it is?
Yeah, it's Roman numerals, and I'm crap at Roman numerals. It's LXV211.
What is that? 67.
67. Thanks, man. It's the end of the 67th chapter.
All right.
I was talking to him. He says, well, I can't say anything about other people. I can only speak for myself. This is Philip speaking. The illusion of free will is so strong in my mind that I can get away from it, but I believe it is only an illusion. But it is an illusion which is one of the strongest motives of my actions. Before I do anything, I feel that I have a choice, and that influences what I do. But afterwards, when the thing is done, I believe that it is inevitable from all eternity. And, I mean, like, I feel like you could take like a bunch of passages of this book, and it is, it's really interesting, like, because this is a big book.
Yeah.
But like, you could take a bunch of passages from this book and you could sort of like isolate a paragraph or two, and it feels like that paragraph or two refracts across the whole book.
Right, it's a absolutely.
Very clean book. I mean, like, his ideas come through very strongly.
Yeah.
And clearly and continuously resonate.
Yeah.
But that to me is like just continuously where Philip finds himself. Like, that is what he finds himself in. It's like the illusion of free choice, but it being an essential illusion. Like, right. That is it. And I was curious, do you think in the end, when he makes the choice to marry Sally, is that agency?
Nah. people don't have agency. I know back at UAF, I was all about existentialism, and to some extent, really, after I left UAF, I had a conversation with this awesome coworker named Lisa at Cincinnati State when I was a tutor there, and I was like, you know, she is a fair bit older than me, and she has a PhD, and, you know, so I kind of feel maybe a little intimidated, but I'm like, I want to talk to her about literature and whatnot. So I asked her if she'd read the Iliad, and she was like, yeah. And then we talked about how we like both like the same translation and all that, blah, 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 blah. And then this is backstory that isn't really necessary, but it adds color. And then, you know, we got onto the question, or she said something like, you know, back in the day, I thought I was an existentialist, but it turns out I just really liked Camus. And yeah. I was like, exactly. That's exactly how I feel. For a long time there, I thought I was an existentialist, but it turns out I just think Camus is fucking great, which I still think he's great. And he wasn't an existentialist, and I'm not really either. Because to be an existentialist, you kind of have to value choice over everything else. Like, it doesn't really matter what the choice is. It's just important that you choose. And I do believe that human beings make choices. Absolutely, we make choices. But are we in the sense that the self, which is realized by cognitive states, right? So right, the self, the only way we can say we have a self is by pointing to the phenomenological experience that you and I are having right now, right? Just what you're aware of. And ultimately it comes down to the fact that self, that phenomenological experience, is a function of brain states, and that function doesn't have any causal effect, you know? So some stimulus enters my mind and some chemicals start to whir around, and then that results in a cognitive state. And my cognitive state doesn't have any backwards effect. Like, my cognitive states can't affect what my brain chemistry is. And that's the only real way I could say we would have free will or we would have agency. And by saying that somehow a cognitive state, which is dependent on a brain state, then creates a subsequent brain state. That doesn't seem to make sense to me.
No, it doesn't make sense at all, Patrick.
Yeah. So I would say that we don't have free will, and I think that there are some real changes that should be made.
What do you think in the context of the book? Do you think that there is still no free will?
I think that Mom thinks there's free will. Like, probably at the end. Well, no, I don't know. Now that I think about it, I don't know, because maybe I don't know about whether Mom thinks there's free will, But at the end of the novel, you know, Philip, you know, he's thinking about traveling, and when he finds out that Sally might be pregnant, he's like, oh, fuck, you know, I'm not going to be able to travel, right? And then, and then she says she's not pregnant, and he's like, oh, fuck, I'm not going to be able to marry Sally, right?
I'm not going to be forced to marry Sally.
Right, right. And this gives him the realization that he doesn't really want to travel, that this is some kind of, you know, thing that he's been told that he wants.
Yeah.
So,
well, no, I have that quote. I have that quote. Can I read it?
All right. Yeah.
So this is basically right when she says that she's not pregnant, and he's in his brain, you know, I empathize with Philip, because I operate in much the same manner. When I'm startled, sure. I go directly into my head. He says, what did he care? What did he care for Spain and its cities, Cordova, Toledo, Leon? What to him were the pagodas of Burma and the Lucis-Corse lagoons of the South Sea Islands? America was here, and now it seemed to him that all his life he had followed the ideals that other people, by their words or their writings, had instilled in him, and never the desires of his own heart. Always his course had been swayed by what he thought he should do, and never by what he wanted with his whole soul to do. I have to say, this feels like an incomplete epiphany. Like, it does. It feels like a rationalization of what has come before. He frames it. He's like, that was before, and this is now. But it feels like a little bit of a delusion to reinstill an idea of free will at this moment. Like, to me. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you. I was flipping to that section in my text, and
I'm sorry.
No, I want to read it again. Okay, so what was your question again?
I guess it's more, I feel like Mom is painting this. Getting away from authorial intent, let's not say what Mom was trying to do necessarily, but
I'm not the police.
Yeah, not the, yeah, whatever. I won't have to, you don't have to go back to this section necessarily. It's right when I'm going to compare this to an earlier, like, quote from the book. It's right where he learns that that Hayward's dead, and he's kind of ruminating on that, and he said, and it's basically, Philip had cultivated a certain disdain for idealism. He had always had a passion for life, and the idealism he had come across seemed to him for the most part a cowardly shrinking from it. The idealist withdrew himself because he could not suffer the jostling of the human crowd. He had not the strength to fight, and so called the battle vulgar. He was vain, and since his fellows would not take him at his own estimate, consoled himself with despising his fellows, which is a great line.
Yeah.
But I feel like
the first quote you read is like kind of undermining that.
Yeah. Basically, like at the end, he's like, oh, I've been an idealist all along.
Right.
I should just get married and have kids.
Yeah. it rings a little hollow, I would say.
Yeah. It's important to him. It's important to him to feel like he has control. I mean, like, right. and that's how we frame all of our choices, right?
Right.
That's how we survive. That's how we function as a human being. We have to structure this as like, oh my gosh, I was blind, but now I can see.
Right.
You know, like that's what makes the choice meaningful to us. And that's what makes this choice meaningful to Philip. But I don't think that he has agency here.
Me neither.
Go ahead.
I think that, you know, here we see it dawning on him what he really wants. And that's fine.
Or what he thinks he wants.
Right, what he thinks he wants.
Now.
And that's fine, but then, you know, like you said, it's like, oh, I've been an idealist all along. I'm, you know, but it, I don't know. I mean, there's definitely tension between the two quotes, but I don't know exactly where the novel comes down. Like, let's say you read something earlier about how where Philip was like, you know, in the end, it's important. I have to operate from this idea of the illusion of choice.
Yeah.
So maybe the novel says, you know, we don't have free will, but we need to think, we need to operate from the illusion of choice. We need to operate from the illusion of free will. And maybe that's what this last line, this last part is saying.
Yeah, I think you could say that. I think you could say that there's another side to that coin, which is that it's impossible to maintain consciousness of your lack of free will and feel like you're making meaningful choices.
Right.
He can't. He feels like he's an anti-idealist, and he is constantly like rejecting or sort of stepping away from the structures that society presents to him. And in the end, he contorts his brain in such a way as to think that marrying and starting a family is an anti-idealist.
Right.
It's just what it is like, idealism is simply, and the structures that we live within are inescapable. We recreate them, and you can't reject them outright.
Right.
Because there's nothing else. And I mean, I think it just seems to me like, you know, he's like a hamster who's discovered, like, oh my gosh, there's all these other tubes, you know, like, and I'm outside of where I was before. I'm outside of everything. This is the great knowledge. This is what, you know, this is the curvature of the earth, you know, from space.
Right.
And, you know, I see it now. And, you know, it's good. That's important to him. It is maybe enough to make this a happy, loving marriage. And but I actually don't know. His instincts are so, I don't know if this book is really saying like he's just going to be happy or unhappy. I don't know if that matters necessarily. He's happy now.
Right.
And, you know, that's good. But it also is, it's not free will that
right.
brings him to this place.
It's definitely not free will. But, and, you know, I'm reminded here of something that Orwell said in an essay, which I find it extremely moving what he said, but also kind of extremely strange coming from him. I forget which essay it was in, but he said basically that, you know, people think that they need to have these extraordinary lives. They need to do all of these huge heroic things. But in reality, you can have a wonderful life that's perfectly ordinary. And that seems to be what Philip is opting for here. Not to say that he will have a wonderful life, but that's what he hopes for, right? He had not seen also that the simplest pattern, that in which a man was born, worked, married, had children, and died, was likewise the most perfect. So he's opting for this ordinary life. Now, I find it interesting that Orwell said that, because I don't see how you can say he had an ordinary life. I mean, the guy was shot in the throat in a battle against fascism. So yeah. that seems out of the ordinary to me. But I don't know. Again, I feel like it's definitely, I don't know what the novel is saying. I don't know whether it is what it's saying ultimately about free will, what it's saying about choice. I think that certainly it seems to say right here that the simplest pattern, that ordinary life, is good. But you can have an ordinary life whether there's free will or whether there's not free will, right?
Yeah, and I would take a step back. I'm a step back from you, and I think that it's not. It's saying that the most important thing is that he can frame this choice for an ordinary life. Not so, like, there's a couple of instance where he encounters a former companion, and the companion's like, "You never got back to me when I wrote you." And Philip's like, "I never got your letter." And it's because Philip is no longer in medical school, and he's basically like impoverished.
All right.
And he realizes in this interaction, he's kind of like enjoying how like his state, his like, his economic state is, or financial state is makes this other guy uncomfortable. he kind of gets pleasure from it, and he realizes that he's sort of happy, you know, yeah. And it sort of mirrors when, he realizes that Sally isn't pregnant, and that makes him unhappy, like, right. Feeling trapped, kind of feeling like pinched by life, sort of gives him a little bit of pleasure, you know, like having like tight parameters on him,
right?
And that's not universally true in this book, but like, you know, there is a kind of a release that comes from not having to think about like what you're going to do or where you're going to go. Like, you have to do things. And I feel like I don't know, like, it's more of a psychological reading. I think what's important to him is feeling like he's choosing to have that restricted life,
even though he's not choosing.
Yes, right. That's what I think is important.
Like, okay, I like that. I'm gonna edit the audio so that it sounds like I said it, because it's so great. Yeah, okay. No, I like that. It's not saying that that this ordinary life is good so much as it's good that he's able, maybe not even good, but it's beneficial to him to be able to pull back and feel that he ultimately made the decision, you know, has chosen this ordinary life. Yeah, I like that a lot. That makes sense. And it's, you know, it fits a little bit better with the rest of the book, which is pretty much unremittingly skeptical of the concept of free will.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I have a, oh, sorry.
No, go on.
I have a question, because I feel like there's a part of this that kind of bleeds into an not necessarily an anti-socialist argument, but something that is in the book. So maybe one of my favorite scenes in the book, and it's not favorite because I thought it was happy in any way, but because I thought it was just really beautifully sad, was when he, the woman dies giving birth in that low class neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
And her husband is just her young, she's 16, he's 18, and they only have one, like, they don't have any furniture. They just have a bed. And it's just this really, like, there's this really understated moment where, like, Philip is joined by another specialist, who can't do anything. The woman dies. The husband is just
basically speechless standing there. And the husband says he doesn't have anywhere to sleep because the body of his wife is in the only bed.
Right.
And these two doctors kind of just leave, you know, like there's even a moment where like the specialist goes to shake the husband's hand. And mom comments that when the man reaches out, the specialist like inspects the hand to make sure it's clean before he shakes his hand. And it's just so, it's such a gross, sad, like
that's awful.
It's really awful. And Philip is obviously like wrecked by it. Like he thinks about it, but they don't do anything about like this poor, like man who makes no money, whose wife just died in the only bed, you know? And it's just like, and he says, I think it's in that section. They run to, this line runs together with that moment in my head, which is the poor people live across the river and they must just be happy with their lot. They must just accept it. Otherwise, they would run across the river and just burn everything down, you know, like, and I wonder, there's like this weird thing, this kind of like paradox where like, accepting your lot is, that's kind of, isn't that kind of an anti, isn't that sort of a, an argument against equality?
I don't know. I mean, I guess it depends on how you read it. So, like, you know, really that could, I think that could be read from either way. So, have you ever seen the film They Live by John Carpenter?
Yeah. Okay.
So the whole point of that film is that, you know, the aliens kind of want you to love your slavery, right?
Yeah.
Right. So it could be taken that way. It could be like, you know, the fact that they're happy with their lot may just mean that the elite or the upper echelons have made them love their slavery. So that's one way to put it. Or we could take it from the Randian perspective, and she's like, you know, these people are just the human ballast. They love how shitty their lives are. And the reason they love it is because they're lazy, they're worthless, and they don't want to think about anything. So it's fine. We can treat them like the shit that they are. So I guess, you know, we could take it either way. I'm not sure.
Well, I guess no. I don't know. I'm not saying like maybe. I'm saying that you have to. You have to reject a healthier state of mind, which is to live within what is, you know, live within the parameters that are given to you in order to change those parameters.
Oh, I see. Okay. So you're saying that mom is kind of advocating that you love your slavery.
I don't know. I mean, like, I think that he's, I don't know that to be true. I just think that, like, it's an interesting thing where, like, you can see Philip growing up and being just very dismissive of suffering.
Right.
You know, like, because he's suffered before and, like, he's a doctor now and it's like, yeah, I used to be poor and kind of like, you know, Maine's governor, you know, like, I came from nothing. And there is a kind of a path where you presume that constraint is not suffering or restraint. You know, it's like, oh, no, that's actually freedom. Like, that's freedom to not care. And to, you know, and I feel there's just like this weird, and I don't think that, I didn't, I think that you could, I didn't read it for that. So there might be more, but it's it just felt like an interesting thing, you know, given when it does acknowledge like suffering, like Mildred's suffering is really awful.
Mildred's suffering is freaking horrible, you know?
Go ahead.
It does seem like in the end that there's nothing that can be done for Mildred because she wants to be in that state of depravity.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, that's right.
Like, Philip helped her gets out of prostitution the first time, but then she leaves him because he's not in love with her and doesn't want to be with her, and she's like, screw this. And then later he finds her in prostitution again, and there's like no way to educate her. There's no way to. Yeah. That's interesting.
Yeah. There's a weird gender thing here that it's not weird. It's in the time.
Right. Yeah. Mom is definitely a sexist, a man of his times.
Yeah. I don't think in any like way that is outstanding.
And right. It's not like he's especially awful.
Yeah. And his female character is very good.
Yeah.
But there's also a class thing here that I think is even more prominent, which is like he shows a person navigating these different, he falls, he climbs. It's not really about that. He never really is even like upper middle, but I guess he might be upper middle. Like, I don't know. Like it's hard for me to kind of like in my head, think about like what exactly, how much exactly Philip had like supporting him. But it seemed like it was enough, and maybe more so than a lot of other people.
Right.
Yeah. And the doctor who offers him a partnership, you know, asks him like, why are you like 30 and you're just now finishing medical school? And Philip says, poverty, you know, and that's true, but you know, he had enough connections and enough going for him. His poverty is not the same.
Right. Absolutely.
As like the poverty of like the husband whose wife dies, you know, who just has nothing, you know, like there's no future for him.
Right.
And he even he comments on the wife, the 16-year-old girl, like she's very pretty, which is not usually the case with in these classes where they're unable to like eat food that sustains their bodies.
Right.
You know, like usually they're not very good looking, but she was very pretty and then she dies. And it's, I don't know. There's something in here that is, that feels, I don't know, open-ended for me as far as like, class argument.
His thoughts, mom's thoughts about class are inchoate and not fully formed, because I don't think that he, at least in this book, you know, personally, he may have had well-formed ideas, but he's, you know, that doesn't seem to be his main focus on, it's not on class, so it seems to me like he has ideas about it, but it never, like, thematically closes, so it's open, and there's a lot to wonder about, what the novel is saying about class.
Yep.
All right. Well, we're at a little over an hour here, and that's usually the time for saying goodbye. Before we say goodbye, though, Chris, I assume you're on board to just kind of continue doing this indefinitely for every month, like once a month?
Sure.
Okay, cool. So what Hans and I have been doing is just alternating. So like right now I'm reading a book that he suggested, and next time I'll suggest a book to him. So you want to do something like that? Like you suggest a book to me right now, and then that'll be what we talk about next time?
Sure. Let me send you a suggestion, because I off the top of my head, I'm trying to think of something that would be interesting to talk about.
Sure.
And I can't, my brain is dead.
That's fine. Yeah. You just send me an email and, yep. but do it relatively soon. So I can get on it. But, yeah, this has been awesome. I think this discussion has gone really well, and I was a little worried because I had such mixed feelings about this book.
I did too.
You know,
we both did.
Yeah, yeah. And not that I ever thought it was a bad book, but it's just so clean and so traditional that I wondered if there would be enough subtext to talk about. But, it seemed like we had a pretty awesome discussion, so I'm happy with it. I'm happy with this.
I'm happy too, man.
So I'm super, super glad that we got this chance to chat. And everybody, thank you for tuning in. I will see you next time, or you hear you next time, or you'll hear me next time, or something like that. Peace out. Remember to check out the press at kaidraconus.org if you want a free book. Later.
Peace out, all.